Just by way of introduction, Grant Samuel is it's a firm that's been operating in Australia for a bit over 20 years, predominantly in the corporate advisory space. It was started 20 odd years ago by Ross Grant, who's still active in the firm and in the firm's chairman, and Graham Samuel. And most of you would know Graham Samuel today as the Competition and Consumer Commissioner. Funds management is a relatively new business for Grant Samuel, and it was started just over 2 years ago by Andrew McKinnon, and many of you would know Andrew in his role as Chief Executive of Credit Suisse Asset Management. Grant Samuel is not a product manufacturer. We're a distributor, and we align ourselves with what we believe are high-quality partners. Our partners are Epic on the international side, where we've had great success institutionally, as well as we're now seeing fantastic flows in retail, and Tribeca Investment Partners. Tribeca Investment Partners comes out of Jenkins Investment Management, and Jenkins is probably best known in this market for its small cap products, and they've been operating for approximately a bit over 10 years now, I suppose. And Grant Samuel took an equity position in Tribeca Investment Partners in May of last year. And when we took that equity position, we were particularly attracted, obviously, to the small cap capability, but to this long short product, and this, which is managed by way of active extension. And we really think that this product has already been successful in institutional space, and we think it'll follow into retail. And that was the principal reason why we invest in this business. So I'll hand over to Sean. Sean's the portfolio manager for the long short product and an industry expert on active extension. So thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Damien, and good afternoon, everyone. Quick look at the disclaimer. What I'll do today is try and get everyone on the same page. So I'll run through firstly what is active extension. It is a product, a class of product that's had a few sort of speed bumps to deal with over the last little while, which include bans on short selling. Short selling is a key function within an active extension product. And with the global financial crisis, there's also been some poor performance from active extension as a whole. And I'll briefly examine what's caused that and what the implications are for the future and where the future of active extension is. So without further ado, what is active extension? It really involves taking part of your portfolio, short selling it, crystallising the cash of those short sales, and then reinvesting it back into long stocks. So it's commonly known as long short. You'll see terms such as 130-30, equitised long short sitting out there. And what it's doing is trying to overcome benchmark limitations and give greater exposure to a manager's stock selection ability. Not to be confused with hedge funds. Whilst it may fall within a broader definition of hedge funds are generally known as market neutral style funds. They may be 100 long, 100 short, and managed against the cash benchmark. They might even gear up further and be 200, 300 long, 200, 300 short across a range of different products. Hedge funds generally give you no exposure to markets and give you pure alpha. Active extension, like by contrast, generally gives you full beta. There are variable beta variations of it, but the product that we run, the bulk of the products out there, give full exposure to the market. So to get over the common misconceptions, it doesn't give necessarily downside protection in bear markets, because all of the short sales do get reinvested back into the long side of the portfolio. But what it does do is gives your investment manager the opportunity to take on a lot more active positions and really leverage up their investment process and get the most alpha as possible into the portfolio. So what does that really mean, benchmark skew? This is a chart here of the ASX 200 index, the market capitalisation there. Now, if you're struggling to see what the little points are at the bottom, that's because they're almost zero. So you've got your largest stock in the index, BHP, 13% market cap. You've got the major banks, Telstra, Woolworths. It quickly drops off till you get to the stock number 100 and you get about a 12 basis point index weight. And you go down to stock number 200 and you're looking at 1.5 basis points. what that means is for an active manager, their ability to actually add value from identifying stocks that underperform the market are really restricted to the top 20 or 30 stocks. And that is a major limitation for an active investor. You're really tied to that benchmark. The only way to get away from that, in a long-only perspective, is to start concentrating your portfolio, taking on a lot more risk in terms of style bias and exposure to market cycles. Now, what we do with active extension is try and overcome that by short selling. So, as I was saying before, down in those mid-cap stocks, down towards the end, taking on positions that actually reflect your view on that stock. And that's the power of active extension. Perversely, what it does is it can actually give you a less risky portfolio. So if you think of it, a lot of the time active extension long-short products are targeting higher tracking errors. But what you can actually achieve with these products is targeting the same level of return, say a lower return 2%. You can do it with less risk in an active extension product than you can in a long-only product. And that simply comes through the diversification of your active weights, the fact that you're getting a large number of stock positions in there and diversifying away a lot of the random shocks that come through economies and markets. So that's just a brief background of what active extension is. It has hit a few road bumps recently, though, because it does require the ability to short sell to actually implement that structure. And short selling is something that's certainly been controversial recently, and it has been through history. If you look back through even the foundation of stock markets in the 1600s, back in Holland with the Dutch East India Company, not long after the formation there, you had controversy around bear raids and temporary bans on short selling come into place. We've seen with the South Sea bubble, the South Sea Company was granted a monopoly on trading out in the South Seas. It assumed Britain's national debt. Might be a few ideas for governments at the moment, just so they can organise that as well. But what you saw there is a company with a monopoly performed very strongly, the classic ingredients for a bubble. Mania formed, rapid rise in stock prices. They struggled to deliver on returns, took on more debt, issued more stock. The stock price went crazy and then collapsed. And at the end of all that, in the carnage, people lost a lot of money, and regulators identified short selling as perhaps a cause and put some temporary bans in place. We saw it come back again through the 1800s with a series of banking crises and temporary bans on short selling. Through the Great Depression, the SEC was formed and moved to regulate short selling. They introduced an uptick rule in markets where you can only short sell on uptick in 1938 after the Great Depression took a second leg down. And more recently, even the Asia crisis, you had Malaysia imposing currency controls after raids on their currency and restricting short selling in share markets as well. And of course, most recently, we've seen short sale bans right around the world during the financial crisis. So in September of last year, the FSA in the UK and the SEC in the US both moved to place temporary bans on short selling with financial stocks as the concerns grew that short selling raids would erode so much confidence in those stocks that actually cause a liquidity run and lead to the failure of those companies. We saw the same thing adopted within Australia on actually a much broader footing to start with bans right across the market, which were then tapered back to bans on financials. So what we've seen there is throughout history, whenever you get bubbles and crashes, one of the natural reactions is to try and blame short selling. But short selling has a much broader role in the markets. Probably one of the misconceptions out there is that when short selling is present in the market, that it's putting some downward pressure on that market because people are selling something that they don't own. What you've got to bear in mind is that people are also taking the money they crystallise from short selling and investing back in companies they prefer. And that's doing two things in the market. It's providing liquidity. It's providing pricing efficiency. So having a market where stocks that are expensive or poorly performing are shorted and money is invested back in stocks that have stronger management or industry exposures or are performing better is actually a beneficial process within markets. Having deep and efficient pricing within markets helps capital allocation across economies and is broadly supportive of economic growth. So generally, regulators have acknowledged that it has a very important role to play. And there's been a couple of studies, I think I've gone backwards there, spent a couple of studies examining what those benefits were. So during that short selling ban, that provided an opportunity for people to actually do some academic research and find out what was the impact of short selling in markets. And the first study that we had a brief look at was by Clifton and Snape, and they were looking at the impact of the short selling bans within the UK market on the FTSE 100. What they found broadly is within the financial group, there was a marked increase in spreads of stocks, the bid-ask spread, a decrease in depth within markets, and a decrease of turnover within those markets as well. So that's broadly what you'd expect to see without short selling, that market liquidity was not there. The second study took a more of an academic approach and looked at the impact on the distribution of returns for stocks that were allowed to be short sell versus those that weren't. And what you'd academics hypothesise is that in the presence of short selling, you'll have lower mean returns and less volatility of returns as stocks are more efficiently priced. And what they found looking at across markets was there wasn't any clear evidence of a change in the distribution of returns. So that could be taken as one of two things: evidence that short selling actually wasn't disrupting markets in the first place, but you could also take it as that there are no benefits from short selling. But I would caution that this was a study done during a period of remarkable market volatility where the world was on the brink of financial collapse, banks were going bust daily, and there was extraordinary volatility. So the ability to actually strip out a period of short selling versus non-short selling across that time frame and compare the distribution of returns is somewhat limited. But those studies give an indication that there certainly don't appear to be any derogatory impacts of short selling in the longer term, and they do have some positive roles to play in the market. So I guess the final word should probably go to the SEC in the US, who basically stated the commission notes that short selling plays an important role in the market for a variety of reasons, including contributing to efficient price discovery, mitigating market bubbles, increasing market liquidity, promoting capital formation, facilitating hedging and other risk management activities, and importantly, limiting upward market manipulations. So at the end of the day, there were short selling bans put in place, but the message coming from regulators are they were extraordinary moves during extraordinary circumstances to really try and bring some confidence back into financial stocks and stabilise markets, but they're generally supportive of the practice and acknowledge the role that it plays in improving market efficiency and pricing. So that comes back to the question, well, if it has a role to play, then hopefully by using structures that take advantage of short selling, you're able to identify those inefficiencies in markets and exploit those through higher returns to your investors. And that's really... I've gone backwards again. There we go. And that's what we're really trying to do with active extension. So just to make sure you're all awake, I've put up a reasonably complicated-looking formula there, which comes from Grinard and Kahn's fundamental law of active management, which is basically saying the risk-reward that you get, alpha divided by tracking error, your information ratio is a function of three things: transfer coefficient, information coefficient, and the amount of your investment opportunities. What you do as a manager, you're constantly trying to improve your information coefficient, which is really the quality of your information, your stock-picking ability. The number of opportunities you've got is pretty much fixed to what's available in the market. And your transfer coefficient really represents your portfolio construction. How good are you at getting your stock ideas into your portfolio? And as we saw before, with a massive market cap skew that's present in the Australian market, there are some severe limitations of actually getting your ideas into the portfolio. If you went out and asked a long-only manager, stock number 150, I'll pick one out of the air, maybe 10 Network, it's got an index weight of maybe 5 basis points, you'd say, do you like this stock? They say no. Are you comfortable with a 5 basis point underweight? Yeah, I'm comfortable with that. What if the stock was twice as big? Would you be comfortable with a 10 basis point active weight? They'd say, yeah, that's still irrelevant, won't impact my portfolio. Same with 20. 50, they might start scratching their head. 100 basis points, well, then maybe they'd think about buying some and limiting that exposure. And that what that really says to you is that the manager actually does have a more negative view on that stock, but they're limited by the index weight of actually reflecting that in the portfolio. And what we're doing with active extension is actually getting active weights in the portfolio that accurately represent our views on those stocks. So, what does that mean? What that means is
your ability to actually deliver higher returns decreases markedly at higher levels for long-only managers. So you can see the dotted red line on that curve. That's what happens to your information ratio. The amount of active return you can get per unit of risk as you go up, the limitations of the index start to weigh on it quite rapidly. With active extension, those limitations kick in a lot further up. So you see at much higher tracking errors, the pink dotted line up there is where you start to tail off on active extension, and that's actually more the impact of higher turnover and liquidity in the market than it is by the index restrictions. So what that's saying is for any level of risk that you're prepared to take, you can get higher returns out of active extension, or conversely, as I mentioned before, for a particular level of targeted return, you can do it by taking on a lot less risk with active extension. So by improving your portfolio construction, you can get more consistent active outperformance over time. Here's another way of looking at it. I'll skip over this briefly, but it's coming back to really what I was talking about in terms of portfolio construction. If you can align your portfolio active weights more closely with the information that you're generating, then you're going to get a better outcome. So you can see the blue bars there is really the distribution of active weights that you get, and I should mention this is just with the in-house Tribeca portfolio construction tools we use. So looking at a 5% tracking error active extension fund, you can see quite a smooth symmetric distribution of active weights. To do that with a concentrated portfolio, so a long-only concentrated portfolio, you start looking at the yellow bars there, and you get basically what you get is fat tails in that distribution, a lot of ketosis, and you get a lot more of your active weights sitting out at the extremes, and you get a much bigger proportion of very small weights in terms of index stocks that you don't own. And what that means is your transfer coefficient is lower. Your ability to actually get information into your portfolio is restricted. So that all sounds very good. Theoretically, you can generate better returns with active extension, but what's the evidence really been? Certainly, the early experience was quite positive. You can see just in that first table there, I don't know how your eyesight is, but October 2003 to October 2007, this is a survey coming from the Mercer MPA software looking at managers surveyed and their performance. So over that period, the ASX 200 index did basically 25%. Long-only managers, the median did a little bit better, 25.5%, whereas active extension managers did significantly better, 28.2%. So it was certainly working up till that point, but it hit a bit of a snag when the GFC really kicked in. So from November 2007 to May 2009, the ASX 200 reversed, minus 26.8%. Long-only managers did a lot better, minus 23.7%, but active extension managers did a lot worse, minus 27.6%. So that might give the initial impression that active extension's leveraging through that structure to the market, maybe taking on excess beta. But what's really going on there is really a compositional problem. The early adopters of active extension were all pure quant funds. It's a very natural thing to do if you've got a ranking of stocks right across the market. You've already got that symmetrical ranking to move into the active extension space and exploit that and deliver something more. So within the group of active extension funds there, the majority of those are actually quant funds, whereas within the long-only basket, the proportion of quant funds is far lower. And quant funds tend to work on behavioural biases. I'm not trying to kick quant here. Half the process that we use at Tribeca is quant. But during periods of extreme market dislocation, the signals that they're trading off, behavioural biases that lead to consistent returns, aren't available. And you quite often see those signals disintegrate, and what you've seen is very significant negative returns out of pure quant strategies, and that's not a lot of news to anyone. But when you split it out, what you find is over that period, pure quant did minus 30-odd%, whereas the rest of the active extension managers, and I must say that sample's pretty low, it's about four managers, did minus 16.6%. And I should hasten to add that Tribeca sits within that other group, which is basically either fundamental managers employing active extension structures or, as we do, a blend of quant and fundamental. So that gives a fair indication of what's been happening. So I'll just recap there.
The future of active extension has been clouded by short selling bans, but regulators have come out and given quite strong support to the role of short selling within markets and the ability of active extension structures to remain in place. It's an investment strategy that's really looking to overcome the inefficiencies of the benchmark, the massive market cap skew. The early evidence is all very positive, but it has become clouded in the global financial crisis. But when you sort of nail that down, that's more to do with the investment process that was going into the structure rather than the structure itself. So it's worth pointing out that active extension, it's not a guarantee of higher returns. What it does do is gives you more exposure to your manager's stock picking ability. And if that stock picking ability is negative, you'll get a proportionately worse outcome than you would in a long-only strategy. Now, where is the future for that sort of product? Well, in a world where people are looking to get higher returns out of their managers, where there's more of a focus on fees, I think most people would agree that there's an increasing role for high return products out there in the marketplace. That can really be delivered in one of two ways. Active extension, in terms of providing greater leverage to a manager's stock picking skills, or concentration, where you become completely unaware of the index, hold much fewer stocks and move away from it. And what our argument would be to get more consistent returns through time, and particularly if you're going to be aware of the benchmark, then you can do that more effectively through active extension by really exploiting your stock picking ability, by having greater opportunity to control risk and style bias across the portfolio. And at that, I think I'll leave it there and hand back to Damien.
Oh, okay. I suppose this is where we move specifically into the Tribeca active extension product. And what I might ask you to explain, Sean, if you can, is you say you use a mixture of... can everyone hear me? I don't know who this is. You use a mixture of qualitative and quantitative. Can you just quickly explain to us how, you know, those two processes and how you bring them together?
Yep. So you would have noticed through that presentation I was talking about the breadth of information and really capturing all of the manager's stock picking ability. Let's to really exploit active extension, you do need a broad investment process, and that's why quantitative managers were the early adopters in that space. They've got naturally broad investment processes, and that's the reason why we have a process, a combination of quantitative and fundamental. The quant is a combination of momentum and value factors. It does give consistent returns through time, although it is subject to underperformance during periods of market volatility and shocks. But it also has limitations. So the power of the quant process is really providing breadth to your investment process, whereas it does have limitations. It's not looking at all the information that's available out there in the marketplace, and that was readily apparent over the last year. Markets are melting down, companies can't refinance. Being able to actually understand a company's balance sheet, the implications of shifting industry structure and stresses going through economies, has very broad implications for stock returns. So having a fundamental research capability where you can also identify that information and layer it into your portfolio has a lot of advantage. So what we do is we basically run a concentrated fundamental strategy, which we layer into our quantitative strategy, which has a lot more breadth.
And you talk about style bias and concentration in terms of risk, and our contention is this active extension product gives the same outcome by way of chasing higher alpha, but taking less risk. Can you quickly explain that?
Yeah. Look, at the end of the day, to run higher tracking errors in the long-only space, you've got to concentrate your portfolio. And by necessity, you've got to concentrate within industries, within the size portion of the market. So you're always going to be susceptible to making accurate predictions of where the world's going, getting the sector movements right, and that's and even risk appetite within the market. And if you're successful there, returns will look very good for a period, but maintaining that is very difficult through time. And that's why you tend to get a lot of mean reversion of alpha in long-only managers, because a lot of that alpha is coming from sectoral style bias within the fund. Active extension means that you're able to get the same level of tracking error in your portfolio, but doing it on a stock-specific basis rather than taking on style bias.
So by identifying preferred stocks, going long and short, say, for example, I might want to be long Harvey Norman and short DJs within the retail space. You can take a lot larger relative positions within an active extension structure with that trade than you can in a long-only structure. And that means more of your risk and return is coming from stock selection decisions rather than biasing to broader market movements and risk appetite.
An unfortunate perception, which you know, we all saw in the media during those difficult months of September, October of last year, was that short selling is all about predatory behaviour and sort of like Gordon Gekko, if you like, trying to send a company bust by virtue of selling its stock down. That's not what we're attempting to do. Can you explain how you use that long and short process in, or how you arrive at taking a long and a short position within a sector?
Yeah, look, there is probably the initial thought is you tell someone I've shorted that stock, they think, wow, you think the management are crooks, the company's going broke, something along those lines. You quite often see in the paper, short selling is about selling a share and buying it back when the stock price has fallen and making money. Now, you can actually make money short selling when stock prices go up. The key is to reinvest it into another stock that will do better. And that's what really active extension structure is about. They're not about short selling stocks that are about to go broke. They're about short selling stocks that have a higher earnings risk than another stock, who look expensive compared to another stock, whose management you don't rate as highly. A whole range of investment reasons that you'd normally hold, but it's all about capitalising on your investment insights between those stocks. So it's certainly not about sending companies broke.
And the last insight I'd ask you to share is we use a blend of quantitative and a qualitative process. Can you just sort of put that in context? We're not necessarily saying quant's bad.
Yep. So what we do is, as I was saying before, quant's all about getting breadth across your process. To give you an idea, we run a lot of active positions within this fund, 100 to 110 positions. Now, within that, 30 or 40 of those will be high conviction positions coming from our analyst team based on fundamental research, and the other 60 to 70 are coming from our quant process, which is based on behavioural biases within the market on momentum, medium and longer term, and really valuations across stocks as well. So they're different philosophies and approaches, but they can mesh together quite well. You're able to get the power of high conviction analyst research into the portfolio while still tilting your portfolio to the behavioural biases that exist across markets and exploring the returns that are available there.
Okay, well, I'll summarise and hand over to Edwina and Angela. But effectively, what we think we're delivering with this product, or at least what we'd like to think we're delivering with this product, is the best of both worlds. As Sean said, we're firmly committed and we believe very strongly in quant. But we also are highly committed to fundamental research. And at Tribeca, we have it's a seven-person team focused on fundamental research. And with this product, we really do think you're getting the best of both worlds, the best of the quant process, in addition to an experienced fundamental research team. And if you're looking, if your analysis was based purely on the numbers of the process over the last three odd years certainly speak for themselves. Now, what I'll do is we're in the process of commercialising this product. It's starting to appear on a couple of platforms. We're working through the research process with those research houses that you would expect and demand. And we're hopeful of some favourable outcomes from those rating agencies, which will become obvious to you in the coming months. So I'll hand back to the ladies for the research opinion and we can close the session.
Thanks, Damien. Okay, my role here today is to talk a little bit about where I might think that you might use this sort of fund in a portfolio, as well as raise, I guess, a couple of ideas that you might want to think about or you may not. Your choice, and just to start off with the first question as well. I must admit, active extension is not something that I've spent a lot of time on, and I think it's extremely interesting from a theoretical point of view. So I hope to be able to spend a lot more time thinking about it in the future. I guess in terms of this fund and how you might use it in a portfolio, I think it's actually a really interesting question as to how you might use it in a portfolio. Obviously, it's style neutral, so that it could be considered for more of that core part of your portfolio. But to be honest, I wouldn't use it as the only core fund in a portfolio. I would think that if you were running some sort of structure where you were had, say, two core managers and a growth and a value, if that's how you thought about your Aussie equity portfolios, I would be considering this as the second core, and I would actually be considering it for a lesser amount than your first core. Another way to think of it perhaps is a satellite within a core and satellite. I guess my only reservation with that approach, and it's a small one, is that it doesn't run a particularly high tracking error. It runs around 6, which is fine, and it's quite high in the Australian equity marketplace. But when you think about a satellite approach, you do tend to think of funds that are higher risk, and you know, you're really looking for that extra kicker. And so I guess I think it's a really interesting fund in terms of how you might use it in a portfolio, but certainly I think as a second core fund, or perhaps as a satellite fund, would perhaps be the best ways of thinking of this fund. The other things to think about in a fund like this is, because of the short selling, it will tend to have higher income levels than your average Australian equity fund. It will also, as a result, just because the income is higher, tend to have lower franking credits attached to those distributions. So if that's an issue, or it's not an issue, if that's an advantage, that's something you just need to think about and understand that it is likely to come from a fund like this. I guess in terms of the theory behind something like this, and particularly the way that this fund is structured with respect to the quant and the qual process intermingled, I think, you know, with active extension, what you're allowing your fund manager to do is have a lot more views on stocks, and allowing them to play those views, obviously, shorts or longs. And that's great. You know, clearly it gives the fund manager, it empowers the fund manager a lot more. And particularly if you've found a fund manager who you think is able to choose stocks well and is above the average fund manager in that level, then, you know, obviously that's something you want to be able to do for them. With respect, I guess, to using this fund in the Aussie market, the point that comes to mind is that the Aussie market is generally considered less efficient than, say, the US market, and as a result of that, you know, we've sort of seen general studies that point to the fact that alpha seems to be a little bit easier to add here in this Australian market. You would think then that using this type of approach would allow you then again to deliver more alpha again. So this type of market may well be a good market for alpha of active extension versus, say, the US market, which tends to be much more efficient. The only other points I guess I'd want to make is that allowing your fund manager to have views means that they must have views. And I would have some reservation, although it's not a huge one, with respect to the idea of using quant, particularly for shorts, particularly mixed in with the qual. I would prefer to see, you know, if you were going to be a qual active extension, that you were a qual all the way and you actually had views on each of the stocks that you had positions in. I guess ideally that's what I'd sort of be thinking about, but that's, you know, a point that you may like to rebut.
Do you want to rebut it now?
I can make that question though if you like. I guess the only other comment I have is with respect to the fee, and you'll notice that the performance fee begins above benchmark. I would expect that a fund like this, which is really attempting to magnify alpha, should have a I'm not, you know, adverse to the idea of a performance fee, but I would like to see the hurdle higher than just benchmark. If you are really telling me that you can add, you know, 6% target return with a tracking error of 5, so an information ratio of 1, I'd want to be paying for more than just benchmark from you.
Sure. I'd point out it's benchmark plus base fee, so it's performance fees on a
right.
On a net basis rather than a gross
okay.
basis.
Yeah. Okay, so if you'd like to rebut my point... Sorry?
There is high watermarks in there, performance fee.
Okay.
Well, that's
cool. Yeah. Oh, well, you may like to rebut my points as your first question.
What was that one I was rebutting before? I've forgotten it already.
It was about how they measure.
No, I think it's a good point in terms of the shorting, the quantitative. It's hard to describe an investment process that briefly, but it's a very valid point. What we do from our analysts is get them to focus their highest conviction ideas in terms of layering that into the portfolio. But you can't come up with high conviction ideas unless you've actually looked at the other stocks in the market. So the analysts are covering stocks right across the market, and that does provide you with information that's valuable in terms of checking what the quant does in portfolio construction. So we're not, there's different camps of quant. Quant, which is flies by blind and pure dedication to the model and what it says, and quant that takes on a little bit of external information and recognises there are limitations and got to do that. So we do actually have the analysts giving input on stocks right across the portfolio and identifying crazy signals that might come out of the quant, so to speak.
We might give you guys the opportunity to ask some questions now. Has anyone? Yep. Oh, lots of hands. Up the back there first.
Thanks for the presentation, Sean.
Pleasure.
Are you able to articulate any examples of where you've implemented a successful short sell and put that as a fund back into a long position?
So just to repeat the question, I had a question in terms of an example of where we'd short-sold a stock and then reinvested in another stock, but on the long side. So there are numerous examples of that, so I'll try and think of one. just the best recently. Okay, so one of the things we were doing recently was short-selling Sims Group up at the high $20 level and investing that back into OneSteel. Now, they're both companies with exposure to steel broadly. Sims Group's a scrap recycler based largely out of the US, export a lot of stuff for electric arc furnaces, often to Turkey and other areas. The company made a lot of money during the steel price boom. For the moment, on a quarterly run rate, it's losing money, and it's got a $6 billion odd market capitalisation. So the market's pricing in some very, very large recoveries in steel pricing, whereas OneSteel, on the other hand, it's a company that's exposed to long products within Australia, so good exposure into infrastructure spending. It's self-sufficient in iron ore, so it actually makes money out of higher iron ore prices, and it's actually profitable at the moment, trading on much better valuations. So since we put that trade on, Sims Group's had a profit warning. It's fallen back to the lower $20 range, and OneSteel reported very strong profit growth and is actually re-rated. So it's an example of just within the steel space, shorting one stock and reinvesting in another, where you're not taking on a huge amount of risk in terms of if the world has a double dip and steel prices crash, well, you're protected from your one steel exposure by a very expensive steel stock that will probably underperform by more. If the market does recover and things are doing better, then one steel's got more upside to its iron ore exposure and continuing steel profits, whereas Sims has got to just catch up to profitability. So there's an example for that.
Good example. Another question? Yep.
Yeah, it's a very good question, actually. There's a lot of talk around there, and certainly you go back to when the uptick rule was taken off about a year or so before the last leg of the bubble and the collapse. Some countries still have it. Some countries around Asia have an uptick rule, and if I had to make a bet, I'd say yes, the uptick rule will come back, and the upshot of that sort of regulatory focus will be to just introduce those sort of trading curbs. Not really. What it means is you'd probably implement shorts in the market using algorithms. So algorithmic trading and implementation is something that's been growing rapidly across the market anyway, and it's reasonably easy to program a computer to only short sell an uptick. So it just means that rather giving it to a person to operate, you give it to a computer and they sell it across the day. But we generally try and sell stocks on upticks anyway, so it wouldn't greatly impact our process.
About the funds, what is the risk target range and what is the possibility of your experience that is out of the range, of the risk target range? And my second question is quant model actually factoring in momentum price indicators? Is the turnover going to be very high?
Okay. So the target tracking error range is 4 to 5%. What we've seen over the life of the fund that's been running for about 3 years now is the first half of that realised tracking error fell within that range. We've still been targeting 4 to 5% tracking error, but realised tracking error has been obviously a lot higher over the last year. That's something that's not really symptomatic of active extension structures. If you look at realised tracking error across active managers in the market, there's just such a quantum leap up in volatility that everyone's realised tracking errors have been higher. So that's been something that's given me a few more grey hairs in terms of managing, because you see stock performance bouncing around a lot more intraday and from day to day, but it's just a matter of being comfortable that there's a lot more noise in markets and a lot more mean reversion, more opportunities to trade short term, but certainly higher realised volatility. But I expect as markets stabilise, and we're already seeing it, those volatilities are coming down and realised tracking errors are starting to come back into the forecast range. On your second question, yes, quant is much higher turnover. It's balanced by the fundamental side, but also bear in mind active extension structures increase your gross exposure of your fund. So if you're running a 130-30 fund, you've got 160% gross exposure. That automatically means your turnover is going to be 1.6 times along only managers, and quant is quite a high turnover fund as well. So yes, it's a high turnover strategy.
Yep. Sean, you mentioned
that one?
The question is how efficient is 130-30 versus a long only? But when you consider given equities manager often they have the two products like that, you can choose one or the other. So you're given the increase in efficiency, but the problem when you compare the two is that often the active extension has a 20% performance fee on total alpha. So basically the line here is 20% higher. So
gets all the benefit. So the question was,
well, as an industry, as a product, there's almost no difference between the two things.
It's a valid question. The question was basically, theoretically, yes, active extension delivers higher returns, but what is the quantum of that difference, and is it enough to overcome the performance fees where the managers reap all the benefits of the structure? And to give you an example, realised information ratios in a 130-30 fund are going to be, on a theoretical basis, 1.5 to 2 times greater than a long-only fund. And what that means, if you're targeting 5% tracking error, you've got 5% more alpha coming out of your active extension structure. Now, certainly some of that's being paid away in a 20% performance structure, but 80% of it does stay with the investor. So it comes back to the question, I think, of hurdles as well. There is potentially a range there, and if the active extension manager doesn't really deliver anything more than a long-only manager, that you end up paying away fees. But certainly what you get there with fees and performance fees is that it starts to basically fall by 20% under that line. But at higher levels of tracking error, it's still getting, on an after-fee basis, clearly high returns. And on an after-fee basis, I think that flyer has returns on an after-fee basis.
Yeah, that's right.
So that shows you there's still clear benefits. No. So that's a theoretical without performance fees in it. So the realised after fees, and it doesn't have any fees in the long only either. So that's going to shift all your returns down. Similarly with your active extension structure, and the line will be dropping off at a slightly higher rate on a post fee basis.
One more question up right up the back.
Thanks for your presentation, Sean. I'm just curious as to what your profile is and how much you've got invested in various stocks. So, again, if you get a traditional manager, you might hold 10% of your portfolio now, but actually, you can play it. What would your profile be, your longs and your shorts? As a proportion of
Yep. So our stock ranges are between plus and 5% from the index, and they are sort of liquidity controlled as well. The fund actually ranges between around 130-30 and 140-40, so 30-40% of the portfolio has been shorted, and that will sit across roughly 30-40 stocks. But the size of those shorts will range anywhere between 0.5% and 4%, depending on the level of conviction, the strength of signal for projected returns going forward. And that's symmetric on the long side as well. So active long positions, there are obviously a lot more of them because you've got to hold a number to be invested in the market. But the active positions are ranging from that 50 basis point to 4% sort of range. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.